Hello, I'm Dr. Lisa Belisle, and you are listening to or watching our video podcast, Radio Maine, where we explore creativity and the human spirit. And today I have with me in the studio George Matlich, who is going to talk to us about some interesting ways that creativity has come into his life. And I think, George, I want to start with the crossover between you and the Portland Art Gallery and Jack Gable and a little painting called Sanctuary.
In 2021, December, just before New Year's, my wife and I came to Maine for the first time. We had built this trip up in our heads for about a year and a half. And so we really started thinking, okay, we're going to love Maine. Neither of us had ever been. We had to push the trip a year due to the pandemic. And by the time we finally got there, our expectations were so unreasonably high. We felt like, okay, we're going to be disappointed. And that was the opposite of the case because obviously we live here now. But we came into the art gallery day before New Year's Eve, and there was a big painting right by the desk that obviously you're supposed to like. Why else would it be by the desk? And we spent probably an hour in the gallery. 45, 50 minutes of it was spent looking at the painting, talking about the painting, being obsessed with the painting, taking pictures of the painting. And we talked about it for the rest of our first visit to Maine. I couldn't get it out of my head. My wife couldn't get it out of, I guess, not even fiance yet at the time. She couldn't get it out of her head. And so I called Kevin to say, I can't buy all of this at once right now, but can I pay for this in installments to get it done by her birthday in March? Which, by the way, I'm proposing the day before that. I would love to overwhelm her with exciting things that weekend. And he said yes. And I was able to, in March that year, propose on the 11th and on the 12th, present to her birthday gift, which was a printout of what the painting looked like. And yeah, that's I guess that's the story of Sanctuary and my intro to the Portland Art Gallery.
And it's an interesting thing that, in particular, Jack Gable's piece spoke to you, because maybe you didn't know this at the time, but I mean, he is nationally and probably internationally known. In fact, so you're talking about Kevin Thomas, who owns the Portland Art Gallery. He happens to be my husband. And we went to a hotel in Washington, D.C., and his works are all over the wall and in large format. So it's interesting that this particular person somehow, this particular artist had an appeal for you. What was it about his work, do you think, that the two of you were drawn to?
I'm not going to describe this well, I don't think, but the moody nature of like the yellow hue and the, like, there's always a dramatic sky in the background of a lot of these seaside paintings that he has. There, one scene in particular, Sanctuary, the sky is kind of like darkening right before a storm, and you could imagine it's like a windy, and it's a windswept area. There's just an old boat sitting in the middle of it, and a tree that's probably been beaten up a little bit, and I don't know, there was something about the detail in the foreground with the dramatic sky that we were looking at that, I know, in the 45 minutes we were staring at it, we kept seeing new things every minute or two in the painting. And I don't know. I have no practice talking about art, but if that made any sense, that is definitely how we started getting really excited about what his paintings looked like.
Well, you're in good company, because I have the practice of talking about art only by virtue of having been doing this work on this show for this amount of time and working with the art gallery for about the decade that it's been in existence. So I am, as a fellow non-art educated individual, how did you become interested in art? Why would you even walk into an art gallery in Portland, Maine, if you hadn't even been to Maine and for any appreciable period of time previously?
My wife and I always like walking into local galleries wherever we're traveling. And to be entirely honest, I don't know if we've ever bought anything anywhere else. I think that for the most part, it gives us something to aspire to. If we're in a really beautiful high-end gallery, we like seeing what local artists are doing, because I think it tells us a lot about the area that we're in. I think a good example of a place with incredible art that we've also fallen in love with is Santa Fe. The galleries in Santa Fe are incredible. There's an artist named Charles Pabst that he's the total aspirational artist for the two of us. I have a print in my office, but you know, the originals are unbelievably expensive, and I've never seen something so large before that, you know, totally took my breath away. But being able to do that in each place that we travel, I don't know, it feels like it tells us more about where we are. So it's just been a fun little hobby of ours as we poke around little shops and you know, walk through a new town.
When I spoke with one of our artists, Jean Jack, she talked about the light being different in different parts of the country. For example, so if you're in Santa Fe and you go into an art gallery in Santa Fe, you're probably going to get a sense of, you know, the changing seasons, the light in that part of the world, in a way that is hard to capture just by stepping off the plane and saying, oh, seems like the sun's out.
A really good example in Santa Fe is if you're there in the summer or really any time other than the fall, you would have no idea that the aspen forests all turn yellow and the mountains all turn yellow because of that. And you see some of the paintings and you just can't believe that that actually is what the place looks like unless you're there at the right time.
So not as well known as the New England foliage in the autumn.
Exactly.
So switching gears a little bit, you're an interesting one because you're an entrepreneur, but you do a lot of work in the financial space, and in particular, two different financial spaces. So you're not following a straight path the way that some people do when they come out of school and they're like, I'm going to go work for a bank. You've kind of forged your own way. Talk to me a little bit about the work you do and why you've chosen that.
Funny, if my family watches this, they're going to laugh and think about my eighth grade graduation quote, which was, it's kind of embarrassing, but it was a reference to a John Mayer song about going my own way. But, you know, I think my personality is one that likes to be scatterbrained. I like having my hands in different pots. You know, when I moved to San Francisco, I started a pizza Instagram because I've always loved food and I wanted to explore the city and try new places, and it worked out pretty well. People were very engaged, so I started a little merch business with it. And I don't know, I think I'm someone who's not ever going to be perfectly happy just doing one thing. I think life is more interesting when you are, you know, out there meeting people, trying new things. You know, sometimes you fall flat on your face, but, you know, it's always, you know, an opportunity to learn something new and figure out what might work the next time. And so I guess, I don't know, it suits my personality to have a lot going on. To speak about specifically what I'm working on, I'm at a Boston-based fintech called HomeTap, and we make home equity investments. So really helps free up some of the equity people have built up in their homes to use for any variety of reasons. I'm on the software development side of the house there. So I've been in a product role for the last 5 or so years. And then I think the other piece you're talking about is pre-seed and seed investing in early stage software businesses for the most part. A big reason for that has actually been the ability to learn outside of my day-to-day. If you're able to be involved in companies at the earliest stage of their trying to find product market fit, doing the 0-to-1 product thing, and then taking something that they think is working and trying to actually scale it, when you see that happen at 3, 4, 5, 6 different businesses, you can start to pattern match from those onto your day-to-day. So it's been a really valuable thing in terms of just building my skill set as an operator. I don't know if I'll ever want to be a full-time investor. I don't think I will, because I like being really hands-on on a specific business and kind of all in on that. I just think it's really exciting.
For those who aren't familiar with the term fintech, what does that mean?
Financial technology.
It seems like this is something that, has really hit its stride in the last, I'll say, 15, 20 years. And this idea of angel investing and, you know, all the things that you're sort of alluding to, which, again, in addition to art, I don't know that much about your space there either. But it also seems like there's been some stressors recently given the economy. So as somebody that has been involved in this for a little while, tell me about that. I mean, it's a little bit of a risky place to be, I think.
Yeah. So, not financial advice. It's always important to size some of these bets accordingly, because pre-seed and seed investing is inherently risky. At the same time, if you can be hands-on with these businesses, you can de-risk the investment that you're making. So I guess I'll say that, but if we're talking about financial technology in particular, the last year, 2 years have been very rough. If you look at public companies, valuations are down 90%+ on a lot of the big ones. And private companies are incapable of going public. I benefit from the fact that most of these investments are still on their way to maturing. So pre-seed and seed stage investments, maybe raise a Series A, they still have a lot of time to build themselves up and prove themselves out before they're under so much scrutiny. As far as HomeTap, where I work on a day-to-day basis, I really benefit from the fact that there was a really hard period that the company went through before I joined. We are now coming out of that stronger and more resilient than ever. And I can say that is totally due to the fact that we have an excellent, excellent executive team that was able to slow us down when we needed to slow down and was able to have the foresight to do it before it was going to be a problem, to just figure out how to weather the storm. And we're coming out of that a much more resilient business going forward.
So to people who are thinking about what they want to do with their lives, let's say somebody has graduated from college and they're looking around and they're thinking, oh, I don't really want to work for a big corporation. Maybe I want to do something more entrepreneurial. Maybe I want to have a pizza Instagram, you know. What kind of advice did you find that was useful to you as you were deciding what your life was going to look like?
So the first thing I'll say about like big companies, the advice that I got to start in the Bay Area, to move to San Francisco, even if I knew it wasn't going to be forever, I'm not from California, I'm from the East Coast. That was very good advice. When you start in the epicenter of a thing, you inherently meet incredible people. And my network that I've developed by living in the Bay Area will hopefully stay with me forever. It was the best place I could have started. I started at a large company that people recognize when they look at my resume. That's been helpful. Now, if you don't want to do that, you inherently need to just find ways that to get into a place that excites you, and you know, hope that you've done a very good job of vetting the viability of the business. It can be harder as a new grad to find opportunities that that are really worth your while at earlier stage businesses. So it's usually very valuable to go to a big place, even if you don't want to get yourself started, even if it's 2 years. In terms of the actual fun side project kind of thing, just start, just try. I don't know. I'm definitely a firm believer that if you don't ask, you don't receive. If you don't put yourself out there, you'll never create your own luck. There's a book called The Luck Factor, and if I could boil it down to just a few sentences, it basically says that people who experience luck are people who put themselves in the place to experience luck, and people who don't experience luck usually feel like there's no point in trying.
I understand that you also have, your family has an entrepreneurial background, so you maybe had an entrepreneurial role model in your life. I think that's what I've learned from knowing a little bit about you. Do you think it would have been different if you hadn't had somebody in your family that kind of had a similar approach to things and was working to make their own luck, as you're describing it?
Probably, almost definitely. That and the fact that it was very important to, you know, my parents to make sure that I understood the value of hard work. And that came through summer jobs and doing things for myself as a kid. I worked landscaping every summer from eighth grade through my senior year of high school. And I was a fly fishing guide in college. And you know, I think those kinds of experiences were incredibly valuable. I will credit a lot of my work ethic to wrestling just as a sport. I don't see any world in which I would have the work ethic that I do if it weren't for the examples set for me.
Well, I think that's a really important point, is that many people sort of in a theoretical way gravitate towards entrepreneurial work because they think, oh, freedom and flexibility and, you know, make my own schedule. But what I've seen in working with the Portland Art Gallery and with my husband owning multiple businesses over time, it's a lot of work. You work when you need to do the work, you work based on other people's schedules, you work after hours, you have to make yourself available. So yes, it's flexible, but you don't get the 9 to 5. You don't get to just show up and then leave at a specific time. At least that's been my observation.
It's infinitely more fulfilling, though, when you have more of a hand in the results that come from the work that you're doing. I think that would be the counter to that. Yes, you have to work harder, but if you enjoy the work that you're doing, it doesn't feel that bad.
Good point. And I'm not suggesting that work isn't, you know, fulfilling, because I think there are people who work long hours, and if they enjoy what they're doing, it doesn't feel like work per se. It's just the thing that they're doing at any given point. For you, I know that, so you're married to Anne now, and you're building this new life here in Maine. What has that been like for you? You're trying to build kind of an entirely new network of relatively new people and just putting yourself out there and while still working this job in Boston. Talk to me about that.
Yeah, so I can, you know, to be entirely honest, a self-defense mechanism of mine is like aggressive networking because I don't want to feel lonely. I am a hyper extrovert, whereas Anne is definitely an extroverted introvert. She is very comfortable slowly working towards building a community. I knew that no matter where I moved, I would have a period that was hard for me, because unless I moved to maybe New York, where I know a ton of people already, it takes time to build a community and have people where you have deep connections and relationships. So it's been very easy to make a bunch of acquaintances very quickly, but it takes 12, 18, 24, 36 months to feel like you're at a place where you have real deep relationships, where you could call someone and say, like, I'm having a bad day, can I just talk? I think life is richer and more exciting when you have that. And so, you know, I'd be lying to say it's been sunshine and rainbows on that side of things, because it takes time. However, I've met incredible people who have been incredibly receptive to me. And I think it's simply back to a previous point of putting myself out there. I will meet anyone for a cup of coffee once. I can't promise I'm going to want to go back the second time, but I will gladly go the first time. And separately, I'm in the process of starting Nexus Maine, a networking group that is really it's a self-serving way to try to get more really interesting people to come to me, because otherwise it's really hard to go find all of them yourself. Yeah, it's been a really, you know, on the personal side of things, it's been a long process to just try to feel like I'm starting to build up a base of connections. But we've met some great people locally in Kennebunk, where we live. And for the two of us as a couple, it has been fantastic. It has been so nice to live in a place where we have a little more space, where the pace of life is just a little bit slower, where we can go stare at the ocean and drive to the beach at the end of a work day, or walk into the coffee shop and have people greet us by our name. She grew up in a tiny town in Missouri, and I grew up north of New York City with access to a large city. And Kennebunk ended up as like the perfect blend of what we both valued about where we grew up. So it's been really good so far.
One of my children lives in Savannah. Her husband is with the Army. And it actually sounds a little bit like that they're similar from a couple standpoint to what you're describing with Anne. And I think one of the things that my son-in-law has said is that to not have this connection, to have all of these connections as sort of the hyper extrovert, has really been challenging, because you build a group of people that you work with, and then you come and you're all of a sudden starting from scratch. But the turning inward, I think, has been really valuable as a new couple. Is that something that you found?
Totally. 100%. It gives us a lot of time to just enjoy being newly married and in our new home, and, you know, first-time homeowners, like, actually learning what it's like to own an old house, which many of these Maine homes are. And that in and of itself has been eventful. We had a bat in our house like the first night Anne slept there before I even showed up. So our first month was, how do we fix our chimneys? How are they getting in? Why is this happening? We've had an exciting start, but one that has also in so many ways brought us closer together.
Talk to me about Nexus Maine.
So we launched on Monday. Nexus Maine is at least starting as a Slack group, a community of people that hopefully have entrepreneurial interests within the state of Maine. That could mean investors who are looking to find other Maine businesses to invest in, startup founders who are looking for fundraising help, people who are consultants that work with early stage companies, people who are at a large business that are thinking about being entrepreneurial. Really, if you have the intent of potentially doing something on your own, you do something on your own, or just have an interest in the Maine business community, we would like to welcome you with open arms. And I've been working on this with a friend of mine in Kennebunk named Jimmy. And he also started Blockchain Maine, which is a group of people interested in blockchain and Web3 tech. So far, we're right around 100 members in a few days, which has been good. And our hope is to make sure that it's just a engaged group of people who can find exactly what they're looking for when it comes to help building their business here in the state of Maine. You know, I feel like there's a really special group of people congregating in Portland because they just want to be here. And I think the state has incredible programs to build an entrepreneurial ecosystem. But it takes more than the state sponsoring these things. It takes a number of very large successes that breed groups of people that find each other from the success to then go do something else. You know, if you look at the start of Silicon Valley, the largest businesses were built out of Fairchild Semiconductor. And that was the big magnet at the time. But look at all the people who started at Google. They found their co-founders and then they spun out. And for all I know, they ended up getting reacquired by Google later in the future. But you know, those kinds of successes have to preempt the ecosystem really being self-sustaining. And so the way to do that, I think, is help people find each other that will build the businesses themselves. You know, we have two very large public companies here in Portland, but until they're paying market rate in New York, Boston, San Francisco, I don't believe the talent density that is required to make this a self-sustaining thing will exist here. So I would love to help will this to become a success. And I think this is just one lever to do so.
Yeah, you're describing something that I think is important for everybody to remember. And this is the idea that we're not competing locally anymore. So we're competing with other markets that are much bigger, much more able to actually pay market wages. And in fact, now with wage transparency, it's easier than it ever once was to understand what the give and take is when you're making decisions about your profession and your future life. What opportunities have you noticed as somebody who's relatively new to Maine as far as even you've talked about creating talent density? You know, what are some other things that you're seeing that could be areas for us to focus on as a state?
The easiest thing that I can share from just being a few weeks into gauging interest and a few days into this community developing, there's a serious appetite for connection. Like, people have an incredible appetite to meet other people that they think are smart and interesting and like-minded. People want resources, and I think that's not a state thing. That's going to be what is current in the broad ecosystem that I want to build in. I think the biggest thing that needs to happen is the many disparate conversations, the many disparate groups need to work towards congregating in one space. And I think what Katie is working on with Startup Maine is a huge piece of that, especially bringing back in-person conferences or events. We are working with Katie at Startup Maine, the Roux Institute, MTI, hopefully, Maine Venture Fund. We want to work with everyone to bring this all into a single umbrella, because all the feedback we're getting is, this is a great idea, but there are a few of these things already. And so we're trying to figure out how to work with all of the disparate groups to say, let's try to get everyone to figure out how to find the resources they're looking for under the same hood.
So I'm glad you're bringing this up, because I think that, we see this in healthcare, which is my major field, and that is that you can have a lot of people working in a parallel play kind of way, and everybody's doing it in the way that makes sense to them. But in order to actually build strong coalitions, you have to learn to understand one another, and you have to learn to find a path forward together. And that requires a higher level of skill than simply working within one's own silo. Have you seen any things be useful as far as trying to go under the umbrella together?
We're currently working on figuring out what is most engaging to this community we're trying to start. So I might have better answers for you in a few months, but I can tell you the things we're thinking about, starting with we're publishing our roadmap to the group and saying, like, this is what we want to do. Is this what you want? Are we doing the right things? Please tweak it as you see fit. So sort of the idea of building in public. We're noticing that a ton of people are freelancers. And if you're a freelancer working with companies all over the country or the world, you can get pretty lonely and have no reason to connect with these people locally. So what are ways to bring freelancers into this community in a way that engages them? Well, a friend of mine is starting a referral business platform for freelancers. He's going to help us host sort of a webinar about the best way to build your referral business as a freelancer. So we're going to try to do virtual event series. We're also going to look at a number of just targeted expert in-person events if we can. So bring in a subject matter expert on fintech or artificial intelligence or building a freelance business or whatever the group is interested in, to hopefully be a trusted resource for, all things business building.
So what you're describing, I think is very powerful and really important. And also, as someone, I just finished a PhD, and my PhD was in part about collaborative leadership and building teams. And also, it goes against what has been kind of a predominant way of approaching leadership in the past, which is more of a directive and probably more honestly autocratic way of engaging in leadership. I think the reason sometimes people don't engage in collaborative leadership and team building is it's actually quite difficult, because you actually have to learn to listen to one another. And what you're describing, which is great, is we're going to put this out, we're going to do this in public and allow people to tweet. It requires the ability to kind of listen and also negotiate, and also, it's not an easy approach. But I also think it's something that we need to do now. I mean, we've had a lot of big structures that have been kind of torn down over time, and we need to create a new and different structure. It sounds like you're up to the task, but it's also a little daunting, I would think.
I think I mentioned being a hyper extrovert. I think it's the thing that gives me the most energy and fulfillment. If I think about my day job, I love helping people with people problems. And that comes from an experience that, a really negative experience I've had at work that was really hard for me to get to the other side of, but then taught me a ton about, what you need to do to work well and collaboratively and have healthy relationships and healthy conflict resolution with people. And, there's a ton of research now, and I'm sure you're very familiar with it, about how, like, loneliness is an epidemic. How can you combat that? Figure out ways to bring people together. And so, if this group has zero effect on the economy of Portland and the state of Maine more broadly, but it is able to help people meet each other that wouldn't have otherwise, it's a success. I don't really need to gain anything personally from this, other than I hope I meet some interesting people. I don't know. I enjoy bringing people together a lot. I enjoy creating community, I think this will be a really interesting experience for me, because I really don't want to come off as, here's the guy who came from California who thinks he knows, what we should do. Like, I have no interest in that. I have interest in figuring out how to fill a need that became incredibly obvious to me. And it's also a need that I have. So, I'm solving my own problem.
No, I love that. And by saying it's daunting, I'm not suggesting you should approach it or you should be daunted by it. And I think that what you're describing also is important for us all to recognize, is that when everybody kind of withdrew during COVID in order to keep themselves safe, they also were withdrawing from people who sustained them, in communities that they were connected with that were really important. And I think there will always be that need for human connection. And I think you're just, this is an interesting time because people are still somewhat tender and they're still kind of, they're in their feels. They're trying to understand like, okay, the light's a little bright right now. So I love that you're capitalizing on people's want, well, not capitalizing. I love that you're moving towards this place of kind of helping fill that void. If you were to look forward in your life and say 5 years, 10 years, do you have a sense for where you would like to be? Or do you have a sense for what you would want your life to look like?
Very hard question. And it's an exercise I do every year, like 2, 5 years, 10 years. What do I think I will be doing? I probably have the most type A annual goal setting exercise that most people would laugh at if they saw. But, within a few years, I love where I work. And I hope I'm excelling where I am. And if I think 5 to 10 years out, and I would like to start a family, I'd like to be doing that well. And not pulled in 8,000 directions. But at the same time, I'll always need some entrepreneurial itch scratched. So realistically, I will hope to be running something that feels fulfilling and exciting to me, whatever that may be. I'm very eyes wide open right now to opportunities that might show up. There's a world in which I think it would be very fun to own and operate a Dairy Queen. There's a world in which Nexus Main leads to me meeting someone super interesting and we start a business. There's a world in which I'm doing the exact same thing that I'm doing today, and I think I could be happy with that as well. So I don't know. I'm pretty much always turning over rocks, and I'm sort of open to what follows.
It's such a fascinating juxtaposition because I think that a lot of times, at least in the culture that most of us have grown up in order to be goal-oriented, you have to know what the next step is going to be. And what you're describing is, I am goal-oriented and I'm not entirely sure what the next step is going to be, so I have to remain open. So you actually have to practice this sort of radical openness and acceptance and wish to be connected, which that takes a lot of faith, I think.
Which, for what it's worth, is uncomfortable and has been a process. It's not something that is necessarily natural for people to say, yeah, I have no idea what I'm going to be doing, but that's fine. I've recognized when I transitioned from my previous company to where I am now, I don't like that in between. I don't like the uncertainty. I am infinitely happier when I am comfortable professionally. And I don't mean comfortable as a complacent. I just mean I know what I'm doing and I like what I'm doing and I'm pushing myself there. But that the huge in-between uncertainty of I was a known commodity, I'm now not a known commodity, I need to prove myself, I don't like that space. I really don't. I think it's part of why I don't enjoy the period between Christmas and New Year's at all. Work slows down. I'm always unhappy. I can be in the coolest place ever, and I will be feeling down. I know that about myself very well, and it's something that I need to work on because I cannot be someone who just has like all of his personal self-worth tied up in what I do professionally. But I'm realizing that is something that I need to figure out.
I really appreciate your being vulnerable that way and sharing that, because I think sometimes it is easy for somebody to look, say somebody who's maybe not as extroverted, to say, oh, look, there's George. Of course, this is easy for him. No problem. And for you to say, well, actually, no, it's not easy. It's a conscious decision, but it's not an easy place to be.
It's something that we're all projects, right? And it will be an ever evolving space for me.
I guess I want to finish the conversation with where we started. And that is that you and Anne, you walked into the Portland Art Gallery. You saw this piece, this large piece, which was, I know what Jack Gable's pieces go for. They're all worth it, but they're not cheap. You said, we're gonna put a down payment on the future, essentially, by engaging with this art. If you're looking at sort of the things that inspire you and the things that cause you to want to put a down payment on the future, like what does the next piece of art on your wall look like? This is a very theoretical question. And I don't know, maybe see if you can answer it.
I know what the wall is. I don't know what the piece of art is. The The wall is in our formal living room, which is a shade of green, and we'll be upset that I can't remember the shade. But the limitation is that it also has to fit everything else in the room. I can tell you, if we had the opportunity to buy Angler's Dream by Charles Pabst in Santa Fe, I would love to see it right there. But someone else owns that, so the likelihood is maybe a bit lower. It's a fly fisherman. I love to fly fish, and it's the place that I feel calmest in the world is standing in a river. It's a very active meditation for me. So I don't know, something like that perhaps, but I'm a huge fan of landscapes to begin with. So a mountainous scene, someone fishing, someone in a river, something to that effect probably would be my preference. And then on the entire opposite end of the spectrum, moving to Maine, I got obsessed with all things nautical. I know nothing about boats, literally nothing about boats, but I had to read every whaling book I could think of, Into the Heart of the Sea, Moby Dick. I reread Endurance, which is my favorite book ever. That's not whaling, but amazing story. And so I love very dramatic, stormy seas type paintings. So perhaps something like that one day.
And how about Anne? How does she feel about this?
She is okay with it to a point. she really likes figures in a way that I don't care as much. That sounds harsh, but there's a painting that really stood out to her when we were at a gallery in Carmel, California. And it was a young ballerina, and she's a dancer. And so it really resonated with her. It was a beautiful, beautiful painting. And the girl was in her pink ballet outfit. And that, I think it really resonated with Anne just because that's her background. And then add to it the fact that the girl was holding a violin, I believe, and grew up playing the violin. It was just like her in a painting. So I could imagine that would be her hopeful next thing.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what ends up on your wall.
Yes, it will.
Well, I've enjoyed our conversation, and I know that you have a lot going on. So I appreciate your taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk with me today about Jack Gable and about all things Maine and about your latest adventure here.
Happy to be here. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Dr. Lisa Belisle. You've been listening to or watching Radio Maine, where we celebrate creativity and the human spirit. And we are sponsored by the Portland Art Gallery in Portland, Maine. I've been speaking with George Matlich, and I hope that you do take the time to actually look into Nexus Maine, learn a little bit more about George and about the work that he's doing, because I think that he raises a fair point about us all wanting to be connected and probably being better for being connected. So thank you for joining us today here on Radio Maine. And thank you, George.
Thank you.